quite a task to follow such dynamic and thorough presentations. And actually, I'll briefly tell you that I think the other presentations have focused largely beginning with disparities and then moving more into possible issues related to them and also solutions. And HPV vaccine, we're going to have to take a little bit different approach. I'd like to inform you, like with a case history, basically, of what, here's the outline, of HPV, cervical cancer, and the vaccine background, and then give you a case history of what are some of the key aspects of implementation that have taken place to date, namely the ACIP recommendations, VFC funding, and some successes in different states. And then to talk about the current and future challenges, one of which is to address any possible health disparities, because although we know there are some health disparities in terms of HPV, cervical cancer, and even cervical cancer screening and other vaccinations, we don't yet know whether there are any disparities in the uptake and the possible impacts of the HPV vaccine. So I'll begin just with a general background. HPV is the most common STD. With a recent article by Eileen Dunn et al. Found a 26.8% prevalence among all U.S. females aged 14 to 59, and there is a relationship between HPV and cervical cancer. 70% of all cervical cancers are caused by two types, the high-risk types 16 and 18. And recently, a prophylactic HPV vaccine developed by Merck called Gardasil was shown to be highly efficacious against four types, including those two which cause 70% of all cancers, and then also type 6 and 11, which cause 90% of all genital warts. This was FDA approved in June of 2006, and then followed closely by recommendations by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. It's a three-dose vaccine that's to be administered over a six-month period, and there's a cost of about $360 for the entire series. So some of the key aspects that I'm going to talk about thus far that we've seen since June 2006 were the ACIP recommendations and then the financing of vaccines through the Vaccine for Children program. It's a public delivery of vaccine, childhood vaccines and now adolescent vaccines. And then some successes in terms of HPV vaccine delivery in different states. And then also another key aspect is changes in public awareness. Probably everyone here is much more aware than they were in January of 2006, but also acceptability. So the ACIP, or Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, is a 15-member federal committee coordinated by the Center for Disease Control. It also includes numerous liaisons and associations like the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the group hears information and develops recommendations for the use of FDA-approved vaccines. Recommendations include issues like age group to be targeted, but also has authority to add vaccines to the Vaccine for Children program, which is an important component of financing here in the U.S. that we'll talk about in just a moment. So in June of 2006, just shortly after the FDA approval, the ACIP voted to recommend Gardasil for routine vaccination in 11 and 12-year-old girls, but noted that the HPV vaccine can be given to girls as young as age 9 at a doctor's discretion. Furthermore, the ACIP recommends that girls or women ages 13 to 26 receive the HPV vaccine if they have not been previously vaccinated or received the entire three-dose series. So the latter recommendation is what we call a catch-up vaccine. The recommendations were officially released in March of 2007 and are important in that they set universal recommendations by which provider organizations and policymakers base their own official recommendations, but also by which parents make decisions. And I'll show you a little bit later on how we believe that the ACIP recommendations actually have coincided with a shift in how HPV vaccine is portrayed in the media, but also in terms of the perceived acceptable age of vaccination among research among parents. So this is in some ways an important intervention in how HPV vaccine is perceived in the general public. First, I'll briefly describe another important component to vaccine implementation, and that's financing. Once vaccine recommendations become official, another important component is their financing. And the Vaccine for Children financing is historically an important funding mechanism for provision of childhood vaccines, and now more so adolescent vaccines. The VFC Act was passed in 1993, and eligibility includes children on Medicaid, uninsured, underinsured, Alaska Natives, and American Indians. Once a vaccine is approved for VFC funding, then the government will contract with the manufacturer to receive it at a lower cost, which was done for the HPV vaccine Gardasil in October of 2006, and then the government purchases the vaccine and supplies it to VFC-enrolled providers. But there are some limitations of the VFC, and some believe that the coverage is restricted, obviously, to those only up to the age of 18, but also even among those that are possibly VFC eligible, it's not clear whether or not VFC providers actually see all of the eligible adolescents. And then also on top of that, there's still some private sector concern about stocking the vaccine, especially in the case of such an expensive one. There we go. And this, just I'll quickly go over this to show you how much the VFC covers in terms of overall cost of childhood vaccines. And you can see that 43% of childhood vaccines are covered by VFC, and roughly equal are covered by other or private insurance. So quickly, I'm just going to go over some successes in terms of delivery. As of about mid-year, about 7.5 million doses have been distributed of HPV vaccine. Just prior to that, all states had actually purchased the vaccine for the public sector. What we have found is that vaccine is primarily being delivered in traditional settings, although some alternative settings, including schools, are being explored. And here is just an example of one state that said, even though nationally there's lots of debate about the HPV vaccine, New Hampshire physicians say so many people want it that they can't meet their demand. And as a result, New Hampshire has estimated that their uptake is about 25% in the first year. This is women or girls in the recommended age group who had received the first dose. New Hampshire, it should be noted, was one of the first states to say that they would provide the HPV vaccine free of charge to all eligible girls in 11 to 18-year-old age range. And then South Dakota quickly followed with what they said would be a one-year initiative to vaccinate all 11 to 18-year-old females. So high demand comes in some part from public awareness and potentially high acceptability of the vaccine. Here I'm just giving you some information about pre-licensure data that showed that HPV awareness and knowledge was generally low, but is likely to have changed since media attention on the HPV vaccine and Merck's Tell Someone and One Less advertising campaign. So we expect actually research to soon show that HPV awareness and knowledge has gone up. But even before the public awareness, research showed that HPV vaccine acceptability was generally high among all target groups. And we also have research to show that simple education, which again we think might have already taken place, may increase acceptability, especially among those who mentioned that they were undecided prior to receiving education materials. So a more recent survey of California parents show that vaccine acceptability is quite high, and also that the likelihood to vaccinate before the age of 13, and that is within that recommended age group, is really, really high. So attitudes may be influenced by how the vaccine is framed in the media. These data from one of our fellows' master's thesis show that of a content analysis of online news story, done between the FDA approval after FDA and ACIP approval, showed that coverage of the vaccine was more likely to be neutral or positive than it was to be negative. And that also mentions that there were concerns over cost and increased risk were often cited, although groups, it was very general about who held these concerns. It was some parents or some political groups. It was never mentioned in particular. It was a very general, ambiguous idea over concerns or debate that were never clearly defined. But what's also interesting is that these concerns seem to vary pre and post the ACIP recommendations, and that is before the ACIP recommendations, there was great concern that increased sexual risk would follow the HPV vaccine, which actually decreased mention after the ACIP came out and officially said that 11 to 12-year-old girls should be vaccinated. And likewise, concern over cost increased after ACIP recommendation. That is, after federal recommendation, who's going to pay for it seemed to emerge as the greatest concern. So quickly, I want to now move to challenges for development of HPV vaccine programs, especially in terms of adolescent healthcare access, although research shows that adolescents are likely to have had a visit to a doctor in the previous year. It's not usually for preventive or well care visit, and it's also not more than one. And so what happens when you need to vaccinate an adolescent three times within a six-month period? Also, there are issues of parental consent, especially with a catch-up vaccine, safety concerns that have recently emerged, and also low perceived risk of parents have low perceived risk of their children needing the HPV vaccine, but also what's likely to happen if there's FDA approval and ACIP recommendations for a second vaccine being developed by GlaxoSmithKline that is expected sometime in 2008. But also, probably one of the greatest concerns that I'm going to talk about here is that will those most at risk of getting the HPV also get the HPV vaccine? There was a good quote yesterday that I saw in by John Schiller of NIH. He said, "No one will be very pleased if those who get the vaccine are those who are already covered by cervical cancer screening." So I'm going to focus specifically on that challenge. So there are some differences in HPV prevalence. This is the same article by Eileen Dunn that appeared in JAMA earlier this year that showed that non-Hispanic black women had a higher prevalence than non-Hispanic white and Mexican-American women in terms of HPV. But the same trends are evident in cervical cancer rates as well. Another article by Manos Rai shows that compared to white women, cervical cancer rates were almost double for Hispanic women and 1.5 times higher for African-American women. So we can see that there are disparities in disease. So we look at attitudes and acceptability among underserved populations, and we find that pre-licensure data showed intent to vaccinate was not related to race or ethnicity. But there are some obvious methodological issues, and that is there's no pre-licensure data that focused specifically on these populations. And often they were done within a clinic setting where how likely is it is someone being recruited out of the clinic to be underserved in terms of getting clinical services. But also, these were asked about a hypothetical vaccine at a time where HPV knowledge was relatively low. But also there was a different socio and political context at the time. Certainly the environment has changed since media campaign, but also since political debate over mandatory legislation. And so it's likely that not only the hypothetical nature of the vaccine would influence someone's intent to vaccinate, but also just that we're living in a different environment already. So this illustrates that this is from the same California survey of mothers that showed really high acceptability. That was an overall figure, and you can see that when we look across race and ethnicity, we do see some differences. That is, black or African-American mothers were less likely to say they would vaccinate their daughter than white, Hispanic, or other races. This is similar to, this was from data by Matt Daly at University of Colorado Health Sciences Research Center, unpublished data that I asked him to take a look at, to look at percent of black or African-American patients and whether or not a pediatrician would recommend. And this is similar to what Stu showed you in terms of chlamydia screening, and that is those who see a higher percentage of black or African-American patients were more likely to say that they would recommend to their patients. So this table shows that the intent to vaccinate 10 to 12-year-old female patients is based on the data shows that there are lower immunization rates for African Americans and Hispanics across all life stages, including for children, adults, and persons over the age of 65. And the National Immunization Survey is a data set on complete immunization series for children. This is a parent survey with provider provider verification of records and show that there are some differences across race and ethnicity. It should be noted that the NIS was recently adopted to look at teens, so those parents of adolescents were also interviewed. That began in 2006. There was a MMWR that was published on the rates of adolescent vaccination in terms of Tdap and meningococcal vaccine. HPV was not reported because the official recommendations came out after the National Immunization Survey had been looked at, but we are looking at the intent to vaccinate, and what we have found so far is that about 43% of parents say that they intend to vaccinate their 11 to 12-year-old daughter. There are some variations in terms of race and ethnicity, mainly those who do, especially among Hispanics, that is, those who do not speak English very well, say that they are more likely to be undecided about whether or not they would vaccinate. So clearly there needs to be some special efforts among that group. So some of the barriers mentioned by mothers in terms of immunization with incomplete immunizations for their children include structural barriers like lack of insurance and no usual primary care setting. Other barriers include inability to take off from work and lack of transportation to immunization clinics that may be at a great geographic distance. Individual level barriers include language. Research shows that Spanish-speaking Hispanic women were less likely to have their children immunized than Hispanics who spoke English, which also verifies what we just recently found in the NIS teen survey. But also lack of knowledge of vaccine recommendation and requirements has been an issue for underserved populations. General distrust of the medical system has also been mentioned, especially in African-American populations, who report dissatisfaction due to experiences of racism at immunization clinics. So it's not just STD clinics. This is focus group data more recently that is looking at differences in African-American and Latina immigrants in terms of their perceptions of HPV vaccine. And what is interesting is that there are differences among the different minorities. African-American women were more likely to say that they had skepticism about how effective and how safe the vaccine was. They had concerns about side effects for their children, and in particular of being what they called guinea pigs for the manufacturers. And they said that they would be likely to be motivated by education, whether or not the vaccine was affordable, and then knowing other people who had been vaccinated and had positive and not negative results from it. Whereas Latina women, in particular, said across the board that they would go ahead and accept it, but they had great distrust that it would be well accepted among the Latina population unless there was a myriad of efforts to increase knowledge and acceptability, and that they said this information needed to come from doctors, television, churches especially, but also other women, perhaps women who had HPV or cervical cancer. So now I'd like to turn to issues of cervical cancer screening and what we know in terms of disparities there. This graph is data from the National Health Interview Survey. It shows that rates of Pap tests in the past 3 years by race and ethnicity, and it gives us some idea if different groups have access to reproductive health care. The top red line shows African-American women have consistently reported higher rates of cervical cancer screening, followed by non-Hispanic whites, Hispanic-American women, and then Asian-American women who have seen some improvement, you can see, since the 1980s, but still lag far behind. Data from the National Survey of Family Growth, which is another nationally representative survey of adults, shows similar patterns for having had a Pap test in the past year. In general, lower rates of Pap testing are associated with these factors. All signs of being outside a healthcare system, and that's regardless of race or ethnicity. So we've seen the rates of reproductive healthcare in terms of Pap testing, and see that African-American women actually have the highest access, and that Hispanic and Asian women have lower access. In this case, it would be helpful to know exactly where these women are getting their care and to include the settings that service African-American women and HPV vaccine implementation strategies, at least in terms of catch-up vaccines. So in general, data from the National Health Interview Survey shows that white women are more likely to use private providers, African American women are more likely to use public family planning or hospital-based clinics, and Hispanic women are more likely to be in need of a usual source of reproductive health care. So what does this tell us is that overall, you probably know that the first point, that there is a great deal of interest and attention on HPV vaccines, and there has been some success overall in HPV vaccine uptake. But we still need to be careful to monitor and address any underserved populations that may create health disparities. And the first would be to monitor uptake and impact of HPV vaccine uptake through surveys like National Immunization Survey, but also to look for any differences in racial and ethnic and geographic impact in terms of biological impact, but also behavioral impact of the HPV vaccine, and then to develop appropriate strategies to address any concerns that we may see, and in particular address access and utilization issues. For instance, could we improve access and utilization services in other settings where immunizations could be provided other than traditional providers, and including reproductive health care, where African